What happens when the man who hunts monsters wakes up believing he's become one of their victims? In 1983, FBI agent John Douglas collapsed mid-case, his mind fracturing under the weight of too many crimes, too many killers. He awoke in a hospital convinced he was being tortured, naked, bound, violated by the very predators he'd helped imprison. The voice of a nurse broke through. "Don't worry, John. We're doing everything we can." This wasn't just exhaustion. This was the cost of staring into the abyss until the abyss stared back. Douglas had to relearn how to walk, his memory compromised, his body emaciated. When FBI Director Webster called to check on him, Douglas confessed his fear that he might never shoot again. Webster's response was telling. "It's your brain we care about." That brain had revolutionized criminal investigation, transforming the hunt for serial killers from guesswork into science. Before Douglas, criminal profiling was dismissed as witchcraft. After him, it became one of law enforcement's most powerful weapons. His method rested on a chilling premise. If you want to understand the artist, look at his artwork. In the case of serial killers, their artwork was murder. Predators select victims methodically. A lion identifies the weakest antelope, and certain human killers operate identically. They scan crowds, reading body language and clothing, identifying targets in seconds. Everything at a crime scene reveals the perpetrator's personality. Douglas learned to read these clues like symptoms. During an interview with Charlie Davis, a prisoner who'd killed five people, Douglas discovered Davis worked as an ambulance driver, allowing him to retrieve his victims' bodies. His strangulation method showed rape, not murder, was his primary motivation. Davis had taken a family photo from his final victim's purse and left it on her grave, a bizarre gesture of guilt from a remorseless man. The criminal landscape had shifted. Investigators now faced serial killers who don't stop until arrested, perfecting their method with each crime. To identify them, investigators had to think like them. Douglas's path to the FBI was unconventional. Born in Brooklyn, he dreamed of becoming a veterinarian, but excelled at reading people instead. As a high school kitcher, he learned psychological intimidation. At 18, working as a bouncer, he honed skills in reading body language and managing confrontations. After failed attempts at veterinary school and a stint in the Air Force, tragedy struck when his best friend died in an accident driving Douglas's car during Christmas 1969. His violent reaction nearly led to court-martial, but resulted in early discharge. A chance meeting with FBI agent Frank Haynes changed everything. Douglas joined the Bureau in November 1970, assigned to Hostile Detroit, where agents faced stone-throwing and weekly bank robberies. Questioning criminals about their methods, he discovered that effective criminals studied targets and followed precise patterns, patterns investigators could exploit. In 1977, Douglas joined the Behavioral Science Unit, where profiling was dismissed as pseudoscience. Practitioners worked under one rule: don't embarrass the Bureau. In early 1978, Douglas and Bob Ressler proposed something radical, interviewing imprisoned criminals to understand their thinking. Without official approval, they started in California with Ed Kemper at Vacaville. Kemper, serving multiple life sentences, had killed his grandparents at 14, stating, "I wondered what it would feel like to shoot Grandma." His imposing size and high intelligence, IQ 145, were striking. He spoke clinically about his crimes, showing emotion only when discussing his mother Clarnell's abuse. She locked him in the basement, fueling his resentment and eventual murders. Charles Manson was starkly different, small and slight with wild eyes, climbing onto chairs to tower over them. Behind pseudo-philosophical ramblings lay simple motivations: fame and fortune as a musician. His talent was identifying vulnerable targets, young women with father issues, offering paternal guidance, sex, and drug-induced spirituality. Why would criminals collaborate? Reasons varied: genuine remorse, admiration for law enforcement, hope for benefits, or the chance to relive their crimes. In 1980, Douglas profiled an elderly woman's assault from photographs alone, identifying the attacker as a 16-17-year-old, unkempt, recently kicked out of home, who knew the victim from odd jobs. A psychiatrist had provided an identical profile weeks earlier, validating Douglas's method, immersing himself psychologically in each case through experience, intuition, and creativity no computer could replicate. The Francine Alvison case exemplified this approach. The 26-year-old teacher was found brutally murdered on her Bronx apartment building's top floor, her body arranged with limbs spread, bound post-mortem, with objects inserted vaginally and threatening messages on her skin. Despite a negroid hair at the scene, Douglas profiled a white male, 25-35, unkempt, unemployed, nocturnal, living nearby with elderly parents. This led to Carmine Calabro, a 30-year-old unemployed actor from the same building whose dental impressions matched bite marks on her body. In prison, Calabro had all his teeth extracted so they couldn't accuse me again, confirming his profound mental disturbance. In winter 1981, Atlanta faced 18 months of child murders, starting with Alfred Evans, 13, and Edward Smith, 14, multiple African-American children were found dead or missing. Douglas and Hazelwood profiled the killer as a black male, 25-29, who admired police, owned a police-type car and dog, and was likely sexually inadequate, contradicting theories of racial motivation. Douglas noticed the killer responding to media. After police publicized a false lead at Sigmund Road, a body appeared there. He was taunting them. When matching fibers were found on victims, Douglas predicted he'd switch to Rivers to eliminate evidence. The next three victims confirmed this. Wayne Williams matched their profile perfectly. He admired police, had impersonated an agent, owned a German Shepherd, and was seen at key locations. During trial, he instinctively answered no to whether he was afraid while killing before erupting in anger. The jury convicted him with two life sentences. Though Douglas received both a reprimand and commendation, the case established the unit's credibility worldwide, proving behavioral analysis could solve cases traditional methods couldn't crack. The toll of hunting monsters eventually catches up with everyone. Douglas's 22-year marriage to Pam ended in 1993, largely due to constant absences and work dedication. Only after son Jed's birth in 1987 did he truly connect with his children. Too late, he realized, while hunting other children's killers. The work continued evolving. The unit grew from Douglas's solo efforts to 10 members, eventually splitting into two sections. As unit chief in 1990, he expanded staff and established regional programs before retiring in 1995 to continue lecturing and consulting. When asked about reducing crime, Douglas emphasizes addressing the moral aspect. In 25 years, he never encountered a criminal from a functional family, leading him to believe criminals are more made than born. The solution requires not just more police and prisons, but more love. His near-death experience in 1983 gave him unique insight into victim psychology. Having stared into the abyss himself, he understood both predator and prey in ways few investigators could. His legacy isn't just solved cases. It's a fundamental shift in how we understand evil, not as random chaos, but as patterns we can decode, predict, and ultimately stop.